Chapter 9. The Numinous. Wonder is the basis of worship, from Thomas Carlyle's Sartor Resartus, 1833-34. I maintain that the cosmic religious feeling is the strongest and noblest motive for scientific research, from Albert Einstein, Ideas and Opinions, 1954. She could recall the exact moment when, on one of many trips to Washington, she discovered that she was falling in love with Ken Behier. Arrangements for the meeting with Palmer Joss seemed to be taking forever. Apparently Joss was reluctant to visit the Argus facility. It was the impiety of the scientists, not their interpretation of the message that he now said that interested him. And to probe their character, some more neutral ground was needed. Ellie was willing to go anywhere, and a special assistant to the president was negotiating. Other radio astronomers were not to go. The president wanted it to be Ellie alone. Ellie was also waiting for the day, still some weeks off, when she would fly to Paris for the first full meeting of the World Message Consortium. She and Vega were coordinating the global data collection program. The signal acquisition was now fairly routine, and in recent months there had been not one gap in the coverage. So she found, to her surprise, that she had a little time on her hands. She vowed to have a long talk with her mother, and to remain civil and friendly, no matter what provocation was offered. There was an absurd amount of backed-up paper and electronic mail to go through, not just congratulations and criticisms from colleagues, but religious admonitions, pseudoscientific speculations proposed with great confidence, and fan mail from all over the world. She had not read the Astrophysical Journal in months, although she was the first author of a very recent paper that was surely the most extraordinary article that had ever appeared in that august publication. The signal from Vega was so strong that many amateurs, tired of ham radio, had begun constructing their own small radio telescopes and signal analyzers. In the early stages of message acquisition, they'd turned up with some useful data, and Ellie was still besieged by amateurs who thought they had acquired something unknown to the SETI professionals. She felt an obligation to write encouraging letters. There were other meritorious radio astronomy programs at the facility, the Quasar survey, for example, that needed attending to, but instead of doing all these things, she found herself spending almost all her time with Ken. Of course, it was her duty to involve the president's scientific advisor in Project Argus as deeply as he wished. It was important that the president be fully and competently informed. She hoped the leaders of other nations would be as thoroughly briefed on the findings from Vega as was the president of the United States. This president, while untrained in science, genuinely liked the subject and was willing to support science, not only for its practical benefits, but at least a little for the joy of knowing. This had been true of few previous American leaders since James Madison and John Quincy Adams. Still, it was remarkable how much time De Heer was able to spend at Argus. He did devote an hour or more each day in high-bandpass scrambled communications with his Office of Science and Technology Policy in the old Executive Office Building in Washington, but the rest of the time, as far as she could see, he was simply around. He would poke into the innards of the computer system or visit individual radio telescopes. Sometimes an assistant from Washington would be with him. More often he'd be alone. She would see him through the open door of the spare office that they had assigned him, his feet propped up on the desk, reading some report or talking on the phone. He would offer her a cheery wave and return to his work. She would find him talking casually with Drumlin or Valerian, but equally so with junior technicians and with the secretarial staff, who had on more than one occasion pronounced him, within Ellie's hearing, charming. De Heer had many questions for her as well. At first they were purely technical and programmatic, but soon they extended to plans for a wide variety of conceivable future events, and then to untrammeled speculation. These days it almost seemed that discussion of the project was only a pretext to spend a little time together. One fine autumn afternoon in Washington, The president was obliged to delay a meeting of the Special Contingency Task Group because of the Tyrone Free crisis. After an overnight flight from New Mexico, Ellie and De Heer found themselves with an unscheduled few hours and decided to visit the Vietnam Memorial, designed by Maya Ying Lin when she was still an undergraduate architectural student at Yale. Amidst the somber and doleful reminders of a foolish war, De Heer seemed inappropriately cheerful, and Ellie began again to speculate about flaws in his character. A pair of General Service Administration plainclothes security people, their custom-moulded, flesh-coloured earpieces in place, followed discreetly. He had coaxed an exquisite blue caterpillar to climb aboard a twig. It briskly padded along, its iridescent body rippling with the motion of 14 pairs of feet. At the end of the twig, it held on with its last 5 segments and flailed the air in a plucky attempt to find a new perch. Unsuccessful, it turned itself around smartly and retraced its many steps. De Heer then changed his clutch on the twig, so that when the caterpillar returned to its starting point, there was again nowhere to go. Like some caged mammalian carnivore, it paced back and forth many times. But in the last few passages, it seemed to her with increasing resignation. She was beginning to feel pity for the poor creature, even if it proved to be, say, the larva responsible for the barley blight. "What a wonderful program in this little guy's head," he exclaimed. "It works every time. Optimum escape software. Ants, he knows not to fall off. I mean, the twig is effectively suspended in air. The caterpillar never experiences that in nature, because the twig is always connected to something. Ellie, did you ever wonder what that program would feel like if it was in your head? I mean, would it just seem obvious to you what you had to do when you came to the end of a twig? Would you have the impression you were thinking it through? Would you wonder how you knew to shake your front 10 feet in the air but to hold on tight with the other 18? She inclined her head slightly and examined him rather than the caterpillar. He seemed to have little difficulty imagining her as an insect. She tried to reply noncommittally, reminding herself that for him this would be a matter of professional interest. She said, "Well, what'll you do with it now?" "Oh, I put it back down in the grass, I guess. What else would you do with it?" "Well, some people might kill it." "Oh, it's hard to kill a creature once it lets you see its consciousness." He continued to carry both twig and larva. They walked for a while in silence, past almost 55,000 names engraved in reflecting black granite. Every government that prepares for war paints its adversaries as monsters, she said. They don't want you thinking of the other side as human. Now, if the enemy can think and feel, well, you might hesitate to kill them. And killing is very important. It is better to see them as monsters. "Hey, here, look at this beauty," he replied after a moment. "Really, now look closely." She did. Fighting back a small tremor of revulsion, she tried to see it through his eyes. "Now watch what it does," he continued. "If it was as big as you or me, it would scare everybody to death. It would be a genuine monster, right? But it's little. It eats leaves, it minds its own business, and it adds a little beauty to the world." She took the hand, not preoccupied with the caterpillar, and they walked wordlessly past the ranks of names, inscribed in chronological order of death. These were, of course, only the American casualties. Except in the hearts of their families and friends, there was no comparable memorial anywhere on the planet for the 2 million people of Southeast Asia who had also died in the conflict. In America, the most common public comment about this war was about political hamstringing of military power, psychologically akin, she thought, to the stab-in-the-back explanation by German militarists of their World War I defeat. The Vietnam War was a pustule on the national conscience that no president so far had the courage to lance. Subsequent policies of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam had not made this task easier. She remembered how common it was for American soldiers to call their Vietnamese adversaries gooks, slopeheads, slant eyes, and worse. Could we possibly manage the next phase of human history without first dealing with this penchant for dehumanizing the adversary? In everyday conversation, Dahir didn't talk like an academic. If you met him at the corner newsstand buying a paper, you'd never guess he was a scientist. He hadn't lost his New York street accent. At first, the apparent incongruity between his language and the quality of his scientific work seemed amusing to his colleagues. As his research and the man himself became better known, his accent became merely idiosyncratic. But his pronunciation of, say, guanosine triphosphate seemed to give this benign molecule explosive properties. They had been slow in recognizing that they were falling in love. It must have been apparent to many others. A few weeks before, when Lunacharsky was still at Argos, he launched himself on one of his occasional tirades on the irrationality of language. This time it was the turn of American English. "Ellie, why do people say, make the same mistake again? What does again add to the sentence? And am I right that burn up and burn down mean the same thing? Slow up and slow down mean the same thing? So if screw up is acceptable, why not screw down?" She nodded wearily. She had heard him more than once complain to his Soviet colleagues on the inconsistencies of the Russian language, and she was sure that she'd hear a French edition of all this at the Paris conference. She was happy to admit that languages had infelicities, but they had so many sources and evolved in response to so many small pressures that it would be astonishing if they were perfectly coherent and internally consistent. Vege had such a good time complaining, though, that she ordinarily did not have the heart to remonstrate with him. "And take this phrase, head over heels in love," he continued. "That is a common expression, yes, but it's exactly backward, or rather upside down. You are ordinarily head over heels. When you are in love, you should be heels over head. Am I right? You would know about falling in love. But whoever invented this phrase did not know about love. He imagined you walk around in the usual way, instead of floating upside down in the air. Or like the work of that French painter. What's his name?" "He was Russian," she replied. Marc Chagall had provided a narrow pathway out of a somehow awkward conversational thicket. Afterwards, she wondered if Vege had been teasing her or probing for a response. Perhaps he had only unconsciously recognized the growing bond between Ellie and Dahir. At least part of Dahir's reluctance was clear. Well, here he was, the president's science advisor, devoting an enormous amount of time to an unprecedented, delicate, and volatile matter. To become emotionally involved with one of the principals was risky. The president certainly wanted his judgment unimpaired. He should be able to recommend courses of action that Ellie opposed and to urge rejection of options that she supported. Falling in love with Ellie would, on some level, compromise Dahir's effectiveness. For Ellie, it was more complicated. Before she had acquired the somewhat staid respectability of the directorship of a major radio observatory, she had had many partners. While she had felt herself in love and declared herself so, marriage had never seriously tempted her. She dimly remembered the quatrain, was it William Butler Yeats, with which she had tried to reassure her early swains, heartbroken because, as always, she had determined that the affair was over. "You say there is no love, my love, unless it lasts for a... Ah, folly. There are episodes far better than the play." She recalled how charming John Staunton had been to her while courting her mother, and how easily he had cast off this pose after he became her stepfather. Some new and monstrous persona, hitherto barely glimpsed, could emerge in men shortly after you marry them. Her romantic predispositions made her vulnerable, she thought. She was not going to repeat her mother's mistake. A little deeper was a fear of falling in love without reservation, of committing herself to someone who might then be snatched from her, or simply leave her. But if you never really fall in love, you can never really miss it. She did not dwell on this sentiment, dimly aware that it did not ring quite true. Also, if she never really fell in love with someone, she could never really betray him, as in her heart of hearts she felt that her mother had betrayed her long-dead father. She still missed him terribly. With Ken, it seemed to be different. Or had her expectations been gradually compromised over the years? And like many other men that she could think of, when challenged or stressed, Ken displayed a gentler, more compassionate side. His tendency to compromise and his skill in scientific politics were part of the accoutrements of his job, but underneath she felt she had glimpsed something solid. She respected him for the way that he had integrated science into the whole of his life, and for the courageous support for science that he had tried to inculcate into two administrations. They had, as discreetly as possible, been staying together, more or less, in her small apartment at Argus. Their conversations were a joy, with ideas flying back and forth like shuttlecocks. Sometimes they responded to each other's uncompleted thoughts with almost perfect foreknowledge. He was a considerate and inventive lover. And anyway, she liked his pheromones. She was sometimes amazed at what she was able to do and say in his presence because of their love. She came to admire him so much that his love for her affected her own self-esteem. She liked herself better because of him. And since he clearly felt the same, there was a kind of infinite regress of love and respect underlying their relationship. At least, that was how she described it to herself. In the presence of so many of her friends, she had felt an undercurrent of loneliness. With Ken, it was gone. She was comfortable, describing to him her reveries, snatches of memories, childhood embarrassments, and he was not merely interested, but fascinated. He would question her for hours about her childhood. His questions were always direct, sometimes probing, but without exception, gentle. She began to understand why lovers talk baby talk to one another. There was no other socially acceptable circumstance in which the children inside her were permitted to come out. If the 1-year-old, the 5-year-old, the 12-year-old, and the 20-year-old all find compatible personalities in the beloved, there is a real chance to keep all of these sub-personas happy. Love ends their long loneliness. Perhaps the depth of love can be calibrated by the number of different selves that are actively involved in a given relationship. With her previous partners, it seemed, at most one of these selves was able to find a compatible opposite number. The other personas were grumpy hangers-on. The weekend before the scheduled meeting with Joss, they were lying in bed as the late afternoon sunlight admitted between the slats of the Venetian blinds played patterns on their intertwined forms. In ordinary conversation, she was saying, I can talk about my father without feeling more than a slight pang of loss. But if I allow myself to really remember him, well, his sense of humour, say, or that passionate fairness, then the facade crumbles and I want to weep because he's gone. Oh, no question. Language can free us of feeling, or almost, dear here replied, stroking her shoulder. Maybe that's one of its functions, so we can understand the world without becoming entirely overwhelmed by it. Well, if so, she said, then the intention of language isn't only a blessing. You know, Ken, I'd give anything. I really mean anything I have. If I could just spend a few minutes with my dad. She imagined a heaven with all those nice moms and dads floating about or flapping over to a nearby cloud. It would have to be a commodious place to accommodate all the tens of billions of people who had lived and died since the emergence of the human species. It might be very crowded, she was thinking. Unless the religious heaven was built on a scale something like the astronomical heaven, then there'd be room to spare. There must be some number, Ellie said, that measures the total population of intelligent beings in the Milky Way. How many do you suppose it is? I mean, if there's a million civilizations, each with about a billion individuals, that's 10 to the 15th power intelligent beings. But if most of them are more advanced than we are, maybe the idea of individuals becomes inappropriate. Maybe that's just another Earth chauvinism. Oh, sure, he returned. And then you can calculate the galactic production rate of Gaulois and Twinkies and Volga sedans and Sonny Pocket communicators. Then we could calculate the gross galactic product. Now, once we have that in hand, we could work on the gross cosmic. You're making fun of me, she said, with a soft smile. Not at all displeased. But think about such numbers. I mean, really think about them. All those planets with all those beings, more advanced than we are. Now, don't you get a kind of tingle thinking about it? She could tell what he was thinking, but she rushed on. Here, look at this. I've been reading up for the meeting with Joss. She reached toward the bedside table for volume 16 of an old Encyclopaedia Britannica, Macropedia, titled Rubens to Somalia, and opened to a page where a scrap of computer printout had been inserted as a bookmark. She pointed to an article called Sacred or Holy. The theologians seem to have recognized a special, non-rational, well, I wouldn't call it irrational, aspect of the feeling of sacred or holy. They call it noumenas. Now, the term was first used by, somebody named Rudolf Otto in a 1923 book, The Idea of the Holy. Now, he believed that humans were predisposed to detect and revere the noumenas. He called it the Mysterium Tremendum. Even my Latin's good enough for that. Now, in the presence of the Mysterium Tremendum, people feel utterly insignificant. But, if I read this right, not personally alienated. He thought of the numinous as a thing wholly other, and the human response to it as absolute astonishment. Now, if that's what religious people talk about when they use words like sacred or holy, I'm with them. I felt something like that just in listening for a signal, never mind in actually receiving it. I think that all of science elicits that sense of awe. And now, listen to this. She read from the text. Throughout the past 100 years, a number of philosophers and social scientists have asserted the disappearance of the sacred and predicted the demise of religion. A study of the history of religions shows that religious forms change and that there has never been unanimity on the nature and expression of religion, whether or not man... Sexists write and edit religious articles too, of course, she said. She returned to the text. Whether or not man is now in a new situation for developing structures of ultimate values radically different from those provided in the traditionally affirmed awareness of the sacred is a vital question. So? He asked. So, I think the bureaucratic religions try to institutionalize your perception of the numinous. Instead of providing the means, so you can perceive the numinous directly, like looking through a 6-inch telescope. If sensing the numinous is at the heart of religion, well, who's more religious, would you say? The people who follow the bureaucratic religions or the people who teach themselves science? Let's see if I've got this straight, he returned. It was a phrase of hers that he had adopted. "It's a lazy Saturday afternoon, and there's this couple lying naked in bed, reading the Encyclopedia Britannica to each other, and arguing about whether the Andromeda Galaxy is more numinous than the Resurrection. Do they know how to have a good time, or don't they?"